Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Politics Done Right, normally with Egberto Willis. Today, sitting in for Egberto is Debbie Lynn Molyneux, and a co-pilot out of New York City is Big Apple Coffee Party today is Sally Swisher. So welcome to Politics Done Right. Sally, how are things in New York today?
Well, things are wonderful. It's beautiful here. It's a little chilly, but it's beautiful. So it's good to hear you.
Good to hear you, too. We're having just a little bit of technical difficulty, so everybody says thanks for hanging in with us while we get some computer stuff worked out here. And I'm so glad to have Sally on with me today, and Egberto is away at the Coffee Party Board on retreat, as they call it. And so we're glad to sit in here. And Sally, I just have to let you know that I had a couple of people text me or Facebook message me saying, hey, I found the test show with Sally. Is she starting a new show?
I was talking to somebody on Facebook today because, you know, I couldn't find the button to delete it anymore. It's up for posterity.
If you want me to delete it later, I will. But everybody was so excited because they are all encouraging you to start your own show. And I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, thank you. I'm excited. It's a lot of fun. I like this so far.
So we're ready to get started today. Boy, there has been such a busy, busy week in the news, and there is so much to cover. I mean, normally Egberto kind of does a current events show anyway, and thank heavens, and it's not a boring week. We were talking yesterday on the test show about, gosh, if it was a boring week, you know, we could actually have real lives.
This is very true. It's ridiculous how much is going on.
There is so much going on, and Gerto's going to be jealous when he gets back and he finds out all the stuff that we kind of planned to talk about today. So we, you know, just starting off at the top of the list, you know, we were talking about some of your and my personal issues that we are really, you know, that just kind of get our blood boiling. And I was talking about the Arkansas oil spill, which I did a whole hour on Thursday. So we don't have to cover that in depth unless somebody else wants to get me going again. And you were bringing up the U.S. Post Office.
Right.
Which has been out of the spotlight, actually. I haven't heard a whole lot about that, but I know that there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Well, you know, things are ongoing. And I know there was a rally in New York a couple of weeks ago because what the post office is trying to do, you know, they've been talking about closing post offices. Well, now they're talking about selling post offices, selling historic buildings. They're trying to do this to the one, the big central post office in the Bronx and Old Chelsea Station, and I think the one in Stuyvesant Town, or one near Stuyvesant Town as well. But it's at this point, there's kind of a stealth action going on, and it's something that people need to be aware of, even though it falls out of the news.
Right, yes. And these are like, we're not talking about like new episodes. We're talking about huge historic buildings.
Right, right. And we're talking about the fact that the post office is supposed to give notice when they do something like close a post office or sell it or anything like that. And
right.
Now what they're doing is they will write a letter and put it up on the wall of the post office, and that's public notice.
In this day and age, I can't believe that's public notice.
Right. So unless somebody sees it and tells a news outlet and manages to get coverage, there's no public notice at all. So, yeah.
That just makes me sick.
Right.
That makes me sick. So we're going to talk a little bit more in depth on that today. We've got Plan B. Kathleen Sebelius got a tongue lashing from a federal judge overruling the FDA. The Monsanto Protection Act is a little bit ongoing because we have 6 months that's in place. And yes, it's a rider actually on an unrelated appropriations bill. We know that. We have Obama yesterday making an offer to use the, let me see if I can get this right, the CP, the Consumer Price Index, but a different, not the normal CPI. on Social Security raises for the future. There's crushing student debt up there. I think a little over a week ago, the student debt surpassed credit card debt by students, and it's over $1 trillion right now. There's the fast food strike in New York. You guys are busy out there, by the way.
There's a lot going on. It's amazing.
Yeah. And then we have the update for the Don't Do Coke campaign. So there is so much going on, and we want to get this show started. Of course, the show is nothing without callers, so go ahead and give us a call at 646-929-2495 and get in on the list here. Sally, I'm going to let you take it away here for just a second while I get called back in on the other line. And
okay.
Why don't you start right now.
I think I want to start with what President Obama did about the budget and Social Security cuts. It's just amazing. The budget has not actually come out yet. I think it's slated to come out on Wednesday, but they've leaked that he's going to propose an offer to cut Social Security as part of the budget, which implies that this is something he's willing to do. This is the beginning of negotiations. This is not something that unlike what has happened in the past. This is not a new position for him. But he has always said he would do it in response to negotiations with the Republicans trying to get them to raise revenue. Now, he still, in his budget, will propose raised revenue, but this cut to Social Security is something that he plans to have in his proposed budget. There's a lot of pushback against it. I know that the Progressive Change Campaign Committee has a petition, and I got an email today. Move On has a photo petition where they're asking people to sign their petition and add a photo to their listing. You know, so there are a lot of people pushing back about it. But this is I don't know why President Obama is so willing to compromise. I mean, we just had an election, and people don't want these cuts. If he's going to go ahead and take Republican positions, then what is the point of winning elections?
And
is
there
that
we
you,
have
Dublin?
It. It is. I is.
Oh,
I got
wonderful.
Back in. Thank heavens. And we do have three callers lined up. I just want to let you know that, Sally. The first one here is Eric Beiler.
Oh, wonderful. Do you want to bring him in?
Let's go ahead and open up Eric's line.
Okay. Okay, Eric,
hey,
I think your mic is open. Hello.
Hey, I'm reporting live from the Coffee Party Unretreat.
How wonderful. How's it going?
It's going very well. I'm just so glad that we have 9 people who are super smart and dedicated, and just the ability to listen and learn and bounce ideas off of each other. I mean, that's really the kind of collaboration that makes Coffee Party move. Here comes Janine. Say hi, Janine.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, who am I talking to?
You're on Blog Talk Radio right now.
Oh, with Debbie Lynn?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant, Debbie Lynn. How's it going?
It's going well here, Janine. We've got Sally Swisher on with Big Apple Coffee Party, too.
Hi,
excellent.
How are you?
Excellent.
You guys are doing awesome. I mean, it sounds like a professional radio show.
Why, thank you.
That's what it sounds like.
I just have one bit of news, though, from the internet. Yesterday, Coffee Party made the top 10 Facebook posts in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which post was that, Eric?
It was Annabelle emailed me during this meeting, you know, with a lot of things going on, and she said, hey, can you make a graphic for this? And it was a quote where she said, in response to President Obama's compromise proposal to make cuts in Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, if that's a mischaracterization, but that's sort of what I got from a few headlines. But anyway, she said, can you make a graphic for this quote? And the quote was, let's just get it straight what our choice is here. If we increase the tax rate for the wealthiest Americans, no one dies. If we make cuts to Social Security and Medicare, people die. And
that's
so I
great.
I put that with an image of her actually interviewing the first African American judge for Dallas County, Alabama, where Selma, Alabama is. And it doesn't show him. It just shows her listening and thinking with that quote, and posted it about 3:30 yesterday, and I think it's got 500,000 hits.
Actually, right now we have 750,000 people saw that post, and it has 10,000 shares.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's still increasing.
That's amazing. That
she
is
said 10,000 shares. Egberto's here quietly eating lunch and listening to you guys do his show. We should get him to swallow.
Oh, that slacker.
If
Egberto wants to say hi, then we got a couple other callers we got to get to. You guys got to go back to work.
Okay, we'll go back to work, Evelyn. We just wanted to say hi and it's sounding great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Y'all
it's
have
good
a great
to hear
one,
your voice.
Okay. Great to hear you guys.
Thanks for all the work y'all are doing out there.
Thank you. Great job, guys.
Have fun, y'all. All right. Well, that's Eric and Egberto and Janine checking in from a coffee party board unretreat. So thanks for them calling in. And we have three callers lined up. I just want to know, let y'all know we're going to get to you. I think first up, Sally, if we've done enough prep here getting the show set up, let's go to Neil in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay. Wait a second. Oh, there it went. Okay. Hello, Neil. Are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. It's good to hear your voice.
I'm starting to wonder if this is some type of bizarre strategy by the president, because you know in basically his budget they're stopping all the form of subsidies, corporate welfare to oil companies, and basically hundreds of millions of dollars taken away from corporations that the Republicans will never go for. I mean, he's basically leading in with Social Security, which will never happen. Because if the Republicans decide to go for it, every single person will say the Republicans are against Social Security and Medicare.
That makes a lot of sense. We've been relying for far too long, though, on the right to reject things that we don't want. You know, I find myself in a weird position when Eric Cantor is defending my interest, you know?
Well, Eric Cantor also is trying to ban overtime. He's trying to draft a bill at this point to get vote in the House to get rid of overtime.
Oh, man.
To offer people the right to basically take off if they have to, but to more or less remove overtime from hourly workers. So, you know, it's the thing with the post office you're mentioning and selling off, you know, things that are historical, nothing ever surprises me anymore. I'm so cynical. Especially with the Monsanto rider. I mean, where were the Democrats screaming about this? That how dare you put this in here? This is genetically modified murder you're putting into our food system. Where are the Democrats? Where are they? Or are they paid off too?
This is a problem. I think we won't go anywhere until we get money out of politics. It costs too much to run. Everybody is a slave to it.
I mean,
And I just want to put in here, I don't know if anybody else saw the John Stewart send-off on the Monsanto Protection Act there, but when we did the hour-long show on this on Lunch with Loudon a little over a week ago, you know, we talked about how this got inserted. It was one of those middle-of-the-night riders that got inserted, and when John Stewart did his send-up on this last Tuesday, he said that it got inserted anonymously. When I did my research the day after it got signed, I found Jack Kingston's name all over it. He's a representative out of Georgia. I did the same research today, and I can't find it again. And so, I mean, I'm not usually a conspiracy theorist, but I'm like, what the hell happened between a week ago and today?
Right.
That it was,
right.
You know, the day after it was Jack Kingston, and now it's nobody.
Jack Kingston got cold feet.
you know, it's like, what the hell happened? You know, he's now running for Senate. And the, you know, the expert guest that we had on Lunch with Loudon said that she called up Earl Blumenauer's office, who is my representative here out of Oregon, and his office didn't know about the rider because it was inserted into an unrelated appropriations bill. So it had nothing to do with agriculture.
Right.
And
it got inserted in the middle. It was in an accounting bill to keep the government going.
Exactly.
There were a lot of people who were mad at the senator, Mikulski, I believe it was, whose committee it came out of. But then she said that it had gotten attached to the bill before she was put on the committee. So it's been there that long?
And so it's kind of like this mystery thing that happened. And then except that John Tester out of Montana stood up on the floor and said, hey, whoa, wait a minute, guys.
Right.
It was Blunt. Senator Roy Blunt. He's
what?
The one that wrote the anonymous Monsanto Protection Act. I have it from my Facebook feed from last night. Senator Roy Blunt admitted that he wrote the anonymous Monsanto Protection Act, slipped into the recent budget act. He received $524,500 between 2008 and 2012 from Monsanto and AgriPacs.
Well, of course he did. I'm from Missouri, and he's been there for a while.
I mean, but I don't understand. He eats the same food. I mean, unless he's growing his own, but, I mean, I've been watching this whole thing about the bees dying. If the bees die, we die. And it seems like, this may sound kind of bizarre, but some of these people also believe that they have to make Jesus come back, and maybe they think by killing us off that Jesus will come back in their own minds. Because that's how crazy it is. Why would you murder, unless it's a matter of massive population control, why would you put in to cause massive sickness and increase,
But those kinds of sickness, it's so hard to trace it back to a particular thing. And there are many, 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 many people who don't believe that these problems come from a source like that. You know, they just can't. How could this be happening? So, if it's allergies or it's a long-term problem, people don't connect it.
But meanwhile, they're complaining there's too much money in Medicare and too much money in health care costs. It's going to increase health care costs if people are going to get sicker.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, I only eat organic. I mean, I look at the products that they're mainly Monsanto, and I don't buy those. They're mostly in traditional supermarkets. I go to organic supermarkets.
Right. Right.
But
a lot of people don't, a lot of people think that that's, unnecessary.
And the thing is, that Kelly Caldwell told us on our show was that organic does not mean non-GMO.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Because,
I'm
starting to look for non-GMO labels.
Which they don't have to label.
Well, and we're the only country, really, only really industrial nation that doesn't. I mean, they've been burning crops in Bulgaria. They've been burning crops in Latin America. They've kicked Monsanto out, and we're the only ones who have a flourishing business for Monsanto.
Right. Well, I've looked on the. There are a couple of groups that are doing petitions asking Obama to do an executive order for mandatory labeling of GMO as a SOP, because he went ahead and signed this Monsanto Protection Act. One of them is by Food Democracy Now. And there's also, somebody sent me notice on Facebook of a march against Monsanto in Flint, Michigan in late May.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that picks up around the country.
So, hey, I just want to comment. We've got another caller on 832, calling from area code 832. Neil, you want to hang on the line while we get to that other caller? Now, we have a feedback loop. So, Sally or Neil, one of you has another speaker open that is feeding back.
Okay, let me – I just took Neil off. Did that solve it?
So we'll get some feedback here in the chat room. You can see if that's coming back through. 832, we're going to open your mic. And welcome to Politics Done Right.
Yeah, hello.
Can you give us your – hi there. I think, Sally, it might be you if you have an extra speaker going.
I don't think I do.
I'm Pinkage, and I would just like to say, I really think I have got serious questions about our current president. I'm beginning to think that he talked a good talk about fighting for the middle class and working people, but yet – he goes in secret and he signs this Monsanto bill where there doesn't have to be any kind of judicial review. He now wants to cut Social Security and Medicare, which are earned entitlements. which are earned benefits, which we pay into. They shouldn't even call it entitlements because we paid into it. And here's a question to ask. Here's a, what I would like the coffee party, everybody, coffee party member, including those at the top, to ask. Why is it that our elitist media, this corporate-owned, why don't they call it entitlements, like the $154 billion in corporate welfare that go out each year? That's a question to ask. What about the corporate loopholes and tax giveaways and tax shelters? Well, how come those, the rich never paid into it, the elitists, they never paid into that throughout their entire lives? How come those are not called entitlements? I really think, and yet you never hear these politicians talk about cutting those and the wasteful Pentagon spending. I really now begun to question, since he did all of this behind the people's back, if this president is even the president of the working people, and he's not willing to do things for the corporate lobbyists who are funding his campaign.
You know what? I'm totally with you. And you said your name is Jenkins?
Pankage.
Pankage.
Pankage, yeah.
Hi, you called last week when we were talking about the Don't Do Coke campaign.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for calling back. Yeah.
And it's also time to ask, like, what does that $1 billion with all of these things that he has been doing secretly and now going to fundraisers and raising money for Democrats, when does this end? You know, when are these elected leaders going to start working for the people and stop this raising the money and thinking about the next election? And I think there are serious questions now that I don't trust him anymore to fight for the working people in the middle class. He has broken so many promises on openness and transparency that money is just going to have to be removed from politics.
Hear, hear.
Time to start a third-party movement.
Hey, yeah, Sally? Well, it's time for a constitutional amendment, yes?
Absolutely. Hey, Sally, do you have a handset or a headset that you could use to – the echo's coming from you.
I turned off my computer sound. I took off the headphones. I don't have a headset. I'm just on the phone,
okay.
And that's all. Can I mute my mic for a minute and see if it goes away?
When you're not speaking, that will help.
Okay. I'll turn it off when I'm not speaking.
So everybody, just bear with us while we're dealing with our technical issue here. So Pankaj, I just wanted to let you know that there are a lot of people that do call the entitlements that the wealthy get entitlements.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nothing that hasn't been done. I mean, but the thing is that right now the wealthy own most of the media.
Yeah.
There was another. And another Facebook post that we did earlier in the week that talked about how many TV and newspaper outlets there are in the country. And when you break it all down, they're owned by three corporations.
Yeah.
Three. And so when you start talking about getting the messaging out through mainstream media in this country, you got to pass it through three corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're doing here. This is what Coffee Party is all about, and Be the Media, and Facebook, and how we spread the word. And so we're doing what we can with Be the Media, and having people like you call in and talk on the show and say, hey, we know what's not fair, and there's so much stuff out there now that's not passing the smell test. And every time I see, we put posts out there, and people are just saying, you know what, if you want to get money out of politics and out of the media, and return to truth. Truth in the media, turn off mainstream media. Just turn it off, mm-hmm. because the more eyeballs they attract, the more money they make.
Yeah.
So if you really want to kill mainstream media, you turn it off.
You know, the Koch brothers are also trying to buy more newspapers, which leads back into the April Fool the Koch brothers, Don't Do Coke in April campaign that we're keeping going through the month of April. But they want media consolidation rules to be relaxed so that they can buy newspapers and put out their point of view even more powerfully. So it's everywhere.
Yeah, that would be so they can do it again.
Well, yeah, more and more, so they'll have more outlets.
Right, they've already done it a lot. So much I can't even imagine. It's crazy making. Well, Pankage, thank you so much. I just want to say 646-929-2495. Come in and join the conversation. We've got Neil in Fort Lauderdale with us. We have Pankage on the phone now. Somebody from 401 called in earlier but must have had to go. We didn't get to you in time. Feel free to call back in.
Just wanted to say we have somebody in the 518 area code who looks like they've been there quite a while. I'm going to open that mic, all right?
His hand's not up, but it's Joe. I know the number.
What? I'm sorry? I'm so sorry. I'm new at this. Okay, then you do this. I don't know what I'm doing. Okay.
So, Joe, if you want to talk, go ahead and put your hand up. Otherwise, so we got a couple more people throwing their hands up for us to talk to now. And we do appreciate callers, and it's only a conversation. Remember, we haven't talked yet about we haven't got the update on the Don't Do Coke campaign. We haven't hit on the fast food strike in New York. Nobody's got me going again on the Arkansas oil spill or crushing student debt. Those are some of the new current events that we haven't talked about yet this week. So just to give you guys some starters. So we've hit a little bit on Monsanto and the Social Security Act, the U.S. Post Office, Plan B. Anybody want to talk Plan B?
Oh, shoot. I was just coming back in to give an update on the Don't Do Coke campaign, if it's a good time, or would you rather talk to callers?
Go right ahead. Jack in Kansas will get to you next, and then followed by 661.
Okay. Yes. I just wanted to say that the Big Apple Coffee Party initiated a campaign that to bring awareness to shoppers about the Koch brothers and who they are, what they do with their money, and how many products they own. We have been running a campaign called the Don't Do Coke campaign, and what it consists of is we get volunteers to stand outside of supermarkets handing out flyers to shoppers to persuade them not to buy the products that they're going to see in the supermarket. This is designed around the Koch brothers' Georgia-Pacific paper products, because those are the products that are most widely available in supermarkets. The Koch brothers own a whole lot of other things, but they're not. These are the easiest to target. Anyway, we started a new action with kickoff on April Fool's Day of April Fool the Koch brothers. Don't do Coke on April 1st, but we had so much response and people wanted to keep it going, so we extended it. So it is now April Fool the Coke brothers. Don't do Coke in April. And we have we're putting up locations on our Facebook event page throughout April. There's one going on today in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and there are a couple more going on later in the month, and we'll be putting them up as we hear about them. So we're encouraging people, if they had a good time flyering, do it again. And if you haven't tried it, it's really easy. It's a fun thing to do, and it lets shoppers know what they can do to try to take their democracy back who want to buy it.
And we do have that 661 area code is Egberto, so I'm actually going to go to him next. But where can people just find the flyer? I knew just looking at the flyer, I just was interested in going, you know what? I buy that product and that product. That is off my shopping list.
Good for you. The Coffee Party has a link to a downloadable toolkit that's on. If you scroll down their front page, there's a blog post about the event that has a link to a downloadable toolkit, which includes the flyer.
So I'm going to put that in the chat room. I know Egberto, I think, doesn't normally run the chat room, but we have the chat room open today. So if you're listening online and you scroll down below the recommended shows, there's a chat room. And I just posted the coffeepartyusa.com link in the chat room. By the way, Bob in the chat room is also recommending we talk about North Korea today. Hello, Egberto. I have your mic open.
Hello.
Hi, is this 661? Is this Egberto?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had this listed long on my cheat list. Who's this calling?
My name is Paul.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm doing just fine. Well, I'm sorry that I jumped the line on Jack. I'll get to you next. Paul, where are you calling from?
Georgia.
Georgia. I'm going to change my little cheat sheet. So what did you want to talk with us about today?
Well, you brought up the Koch brothers, and I am not familiar with that, with what's going on with that. I had some other things on my mind, but you caught my curiosity with that. Could you inform me on that?
Sally?
Hi. Sure. Sorry, I unmuted myself. I'm trying to keep the echo out. Anyway, the Koch brothers are really wealthy industrialists who own a lot of properties. They started in petroleum. They inherited companies from their father, but since then they have expanded, and their company, Koch Industries, owns Georgia-Pacific Paper Products, which sells an awful lot of consumer products, things like Brawny paper towels, Dixie cups, Mardi Gras napkins, Quilted Northern and Soft and Gentle and Angel Soft toilet papers. Those are all Georgia-Pacific products. So every time somebody buys them, the Koch brothers make money. Now, the Koch brothers give money. They've given more money to climate change denial than ExxonMobil. And they also put a lot of money into the last election cycle. They are big, and I think one of the founding members of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is an organization that puts together corporate lobbyists and legislators so that they can talk over what kind of bills they want to have introduced, and then the legislators take the bills home and introduce them in their own legislatures. A lot of these are state legislators. So it's a pipeline for large moneyed interests to have a line into the legal process, whereas people like you and me don't. So
well,
we're asking. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
And
sorry.
Just as another point of information, ALEC is behind a lot of the anti-immigration laws, a lot of the anti-women or anti-women's reproductive right laws. I'm trying to think some of the other, and they template them. They put them in multiple, they take the same legislation and they put them in multiple states at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It's the Stand Your Ground legislation, too.
Well,
there you go.
The only thing that I would have against the Koch brothers is pretty much a longstanding thing that I've been critical of, and that is to have a separation between corporate entities and the government. The corporate entities actually are unconstitutional in that the businesses are supposed to be properties of individuals. The corporations are supposed to have no affiliation with the government, which the government kind of messed that up way back when they decided to incorporate the United States and have the corporations kind of subsidy the government. But other than that, I'm not really seeing, and I don't see any, aside from them having lobbyists and supporting, financially supporting the government, I'm not seeing an issue.
So Paul, your only concern is not the positions that they're taking. Your concern is just that it's the corporate takeover of the government.
They can take whatever position they want to take. My main thing is that corporations and governments are not supposed to have anything to do with each other. Corporations are supposed to be simply personal property.
Right.
And not people.
That is one of the few things with the particular views that's in the Coffee Party that I agree with.
Yep.
I think it's called Citizens United, where they want to have the corporations not be entities. But the funny thing about that is that that's already in the Constitution. The Constitution begins with we the people. And the only time at all that that corporations are, in a sense, mentioned in the Constitution is when it comes to prosecution and compensation, and just when a person has to compensate for whatever injury took place. Other than that, corporations are just supposed to be personal property. They became more than that because of what the government did back in the early 1900s, which that's the government's fault.
Actually, I think it was probably before that. They've been advocating for having rights just like people, free speech rights and protection against unequal taxation, and they've been doing it through the courts. I know that they were arguing after the Civil War that the 14th Amendment, which was supposed to give full personhood rights to the freed slaves, corporations were using it to argue that that corporations also had the rights of people. And, you know, the courts poo-pooed that at first, but it's been a long progression to where
right.
we are now, and they've gotten an amazing distance along that line.
Yeah, it did happen a long time ago. I was taking a guess, but it's been kind of one of those things where just like, frankly, our slide into the great abyss has been kind of gradual and as of recently quick. It's people want to see corporate takeover, but unfortunately, the government really messed up a while ago on this. The corporations are supposed to be under the protection of the of the person that owns it, because they're not supposed to be an entity of themselves. There's actually supposed to be no incorporated. There's supposed to be no LLC, no nothing of that. It's supposed to be strictly personal property.
Go ahead, Debbie Lynn.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Paul, you know, you're getting on, you know, off into, you know, constitutional issues today, and I've got a couple of folks in the chat room who can talk about the Constitution with you. How is this connected? Can you wind us back on how this is connected to some of our current affairs issues that we're talking about on the show today, Paul?
Yeah, no problem. Basic thing is that I personally believe that if we went back to the Constitution, that would solve almost every problem that we're having today as far as the, you know, what corporations decide to put their money into. You know, under the amendments that, you know, of the people, there's nothing wrong with that. You may disagree with what they do, but they're still able to do that.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I've always thought about is that if, you know, and we have a, you know, a couple of amendments that are, you know, a couple of potential constitutional amendments now winding their way to try and strip corporations of personhood. And
that's their personhood.
Yeah, and so making sure that when people, I call it, they get double speech right now. People who own corporations get to speak through their corporations, and then they get to speak through their own personal. They get to speak personally. And
there
so
should be
when
no
we,
difference between the two.
Correct. And so I'm always like, you know, hey, why don't we just make it so that only the people, human beings with a heartbeat, get to speak in politics? And that's, you know, so that's my stand that I take, that corporations should not get to do that. And
yeah.
I want to thank you for your call, Paul. We've got two other people lined up. One of them I skipped over because I thought you were Egberto and it's his show.
Sorry.
And I was going to give him the floor. So, and Jack is a regular caller. I want to make sure we honor Jack. And get to him right now. So I just thank you so much for calling in, Paul, and giving us taking us back to the Constitution, because that is, you know, our founding document. That
that's
really
the cure
is.
For it all.
Yeah, that's why we're here. So you have a good day, and thanks for calling in and giving us that reminder.
You're welcome.
Sure. All right, Paul from Georgia, thanks for calling in. Jack, I'm coming to you next. I've got 641 lined up behind you. How are you doing today, Jack? It's Debbie Lynn.
Okay, this is Jack Golding. You're mentioning about the postal plan B, post office plan B?
Well, we have two topics there. Plan B is the morning after pill for women. That prevents pregnancy. And then we have the post office selling off some of their big historical post offices across the country.
So
we have two different topics there. You want to pick one?
Okay, I'd like to know more about this because I am a post office retiree.
Oh.
And, yeah, postal retiree back in 92.
Yep.
81 years old, one of the things that it's unconstitutional for one thing to mess around with what Congress is doing with the post office, because post offices one of the few places, a few government agencies that were mentioned in the Constitution. Attached post offices and post roads and all of that stuff. Now they want to do away with it private. Well, it's privatized as I see it, because it's competing with UPS and FedEx for business. And I want to do away with the mail, I mean, and on television they're launching, well, it's not going to be, people in rural areas like mine should be concerned about it.
Hi, Jack, this is Sally. And I think you're right, but it's not just people in rural areas. It's something that everybody has to really keep an eye on, because they are trying to restrict service quietly and sneakily, and while our backs are turned. It's upsetting. It's very upsetting.
Go ahead. Post office used to do money orders and visas and hunting licenses and stuff like that. They could put it back to where it was back.
They used to have a bank.
I worked at the post office, and they used to compete with the banks for. Banks. Yeah.
They had a whole banking system.
All
those which...
damn things. A banking system, which.
Yeah.
Earn interest, and they should be able to compete. And that'll put the post office in business.
I think we should revive their bank now, because we have a lot of problems with the other banks. I'd love to have a public one.
I was going to say, I mean, this would be the ultimate state-run bank, right? That's for
the people,
the people, we the people.
And it has all those branches, and that's why we want to keep the post offices open.
And I think it's unconstitutional. You can argue with... I call the ringleader of the whole bench is I call him Daryl Isahole of California.
He is a bad man, I think.
Oh yeah, I have a lot of friends who don't like him.
Right.
He's plutocracy.
You bet.
As far as that, he's one of the wealthiest people in Congress.
Right.
What I've heard.
When you worked in the post office, what was your position? What did you do for the post office?
I was in PSDS. It's probably outmoded by now. Postal Source Data Technician. I did all the lab payroll work. And,
interesting.
I was in charge of 1,300 people on the swing shift at charge of getting the straightening out the time payroll of 1,300 workers on tour three, which is the swing shift. Which runs from roughly 3 o'clock to 11:30 at night Terminal Atlantic. It used to be Terminal Atlantic. Terminal Atlantic was taken over.
And this was in California, Jack?
It was in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles, wow.
And,
that's a huge postal system, Los Angeles.
Yeah,
no wonder. I thought you were in Kansas. I was trying to figure out where all those people were. Sorry.
I lived in Los Angeles area for 39 years.
Right. Now I understand.
And I moved to Kansas on the kind of... Well, it's a long story. It's another issue. Is too free credit? Too much emphasis on credit.
Well, we may not have time for that one today.
Yeah, we may not. I just want to say about the post office, though, I can't figure out why everybody keeps saying it ought to be making a profit. It's in the Constitution as a service for the American people. Why is it supposed to make a profit? The military doesn't
make
a profit.
I think it can make a profit. I think it did for a while there.
Well, now, I mean, it makes back a lot of its money now, but why is it even supposed to?
And
go ahead,
right,
Debbie
now,
Lynn, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, and if
just break even.
And if you didn't have to fully fund the retirement, the pension plan like other companies, it would be doing just fine.
Right.
If you didn't have to fully fund it for 75 years, it would be doing just fine. The way they're doing the math for the Postal Service is different than the math done for any other government entity, city, county, state, or federal. Different.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
And I resent it. I resent it. And that's why I'm cold toward the Democrats as well as the Republicans, because
yeah.
the Democrats are equally to blame for what the heck's going on, for what's all screwed up, as well as the Republicans. Obama can plead all he can. And another issue, and I've been reading that in The Nation, and he's anti-whistleblower.
Oi.
Right.
That's a whole other issue.
Oh, yeah. So we've got, we're adding
my book,
North Korea and whistleblower.
Yeah. And
well, Jack,
read that more.
I've got
yeah.
two more callers
Bye.
Lined up behind you. Do you have any last thoughts for us today?
I got a solution to every problem. It's just they have people got whether Republicans or Democrats, they got to take courage in founding these special interests, the lobbyists, and so the lobbyists. They go right into being lobby from the government.
Yep.
Crossover gotta be ended. It's gotta be, and then just gerrymandering.
I think if we can get the money out of politics, I think we're all in agreement on that one.
I don't know about the Tea Party guys. That's another issue. Got to be able to run against and defeat them all. They defeated 10 of these in the last election.
Yes, the Democrats did defeat 10 of the Tea Partyists, but there's, I think even more than that, the whole system itself is corrupt, and no matter who we get in there, it doesn't seem to change anything. So I like what Paul, is it Paul? I don't remember who, one of our callers earlier said it's time for us to get a third party going. You know, and that might help, but we're still putting them into a corrupt system.
Okay,
so.
Third party I agree with. Third party I'd like to mention is a meld of the two Roosevelts and a little bit of
yeah.
Reagan thrown in.
Yeah. And, there you go, two Roosevelts
be,
and some Reagan. The three R's.
Teddy Roosevelt, environmentalist. I mean, he was not a real Republican as we define it today, but
yeah,
and progressive rhythm started with Teddy Roosevelt, and then Franklin, you know, started the whole business with Social Security and all that, and Reagan, of course, has some good ideas about world peace. Ended the Cold War with Russia.
So
Berlin Wall fall. What?
It did. Yep. Well, Jack, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm going to move on to our next caller. And
yeah,
I just so appreciate you. I know you call into all of our shows, and I'm so grateful that you do. So you have a good day here.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Jack. I'm going to move on now to callers from area code 641. You've been holding a little bit, and we've got 630. I'm getting to you next. Caller 641, who's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Bob Woodburn. How are you?
Hey, Bob. Doing great. I don't have you on my cheat sheet.
That's okay. You can put me in now.
I will.
Yeah. You know my name on BTR, so.
I do.
That's easy enough. I wanted to call in because the moment the Constitution gets mentioned, the hair stands up on the back of my neck and I go into kind of an alert mode so that I can correct fact and fiction, or actually correct fiction and assert fact. What I'd like to know from Paula in Georgia is, where is corporation creation prohibited in the Constitution? In the first place, the Interstate Commerce Clause, the authority of Congress to regulate interstate commerce, says that the framers were perfectly aware of things like corporate charters that date back to the opening of the markets in London rather than the New York Stock Exchange. Second, the 10th Amendment grants to the states all rights not specifically reserved either to the federal government or the people. The right to create corporations does not vest in the federal government, nor does it vest in the people. It therefore belongs to the states, and if you check the laws on corporations, you'll find corporations incorporate within states rather than through the federal government or as private entities. They have to go through their individual state. So
that's really true, Bob.
That one. Okay.
Can I cut in here for a second?
Absolutely, Sally, and welcome aboard, by the way.
Hi. Yes, it's good to talk to you. I haven't heard from a lot of advocates who are working toward a constitutional amendment about corporations. I haven't heard that they want to keep corporations from being chartered. I think what the discussion is about is what kind of rights they should have, and are they the same as natural breathing?
Oh, of
you
course
know,
they're not.
Flesh and
of
blood
course
people.
They're not. But Paul asserted that corporate creation was unconstitutional, and as I've demonstrated,
yeah,
with
you're right.
My argument,
I don't think it's unconstitutional
clearly not
either.
The case.
However, at
that's,
the founding, the rules for corporations were very, very, very different than they are now. Corporations were generally limited to a particular project or to a time span. You know, they would charter a corporation, but it would be in order to do something particular, and then it would end in, say, 40 years.
Right. Conglomeration was unheard of.
Right. They couldn't own each other. Yes, exactly.
Right, yeah.
I know.
I mean,
and the
it
states,
wasn't a grouper effect where one fish is swallowing another, and pretty
right.
soon, you know.
And the state had the right to charter them, but it was if they were going to do something for the public good. The state had the right to look at whether the corporation was doing anything for the public good, and the charter was supposed to be in order for them to do to
right.
be for,
you have
to benefit all
mission.
Of it.
You have
yeah.
to match your mission statement in your corporate bylaws.
Right, but the state had an obligation to make sure that a corporation was benefiting the public good, and they could revoke a charter if it wasn't.
Right, and used to do it. They don't
yes.
really do that anymore, and that's something that can be changed too. The other thing that I wanted to address real quick is the idea of a third party. Not many people realize it, but right now the Republican Party is a third party, because what you have is the Democrat Party is number one in terms of voter registration. Number two is either no party or independent, 40%, okay?
Wow.
And number three is the Republican Party.
Well, and I may be biased here a little bit, Bob, but I actually thought that the independents were number one.
They may be. They may be. I mean, the math works that out of three, they would be number one if they have 40%. But I don't know that the Democrats aren't number one with, say, 53%. And the Republicans third with whatever's left, 7. You know, no idea on that one. But I do know that the Republicans are no longer a second party, and that's the important point I'm trying to make here. There is a third party, and it's called the Republicans.
Right. And then there are more and more.
After
there's
that
the Green Party. There's the
Libertarians, the Greens,
the Coffee Party.
the Coffee Party. You bet.
Peace and freedom. We are not a political party. Just to, for everybody out there, we're not a political party. We're a membership organization.
Sorry. Yeah, okay.
No,
all
just
right.
to keep our nonprofit status clear.
Yeah, I've got a call on the other line, so I have to go. So
thank you for calling.
Talk to y'all next time, and I thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Y'all have a great day, and I'll keep listening. Bye for now.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to that was a great call from Bob. And by the way, if any of you have called that are still online with us that had your hand up earlier, if you push 1 twice, you can put your hand down and put your hand back up, and we'll know you want to come back online and talk with us again. Caller from 630, we're going to open your mic now. And who are you and where are you calling from?
Jeff McKinley from Chicago.
Hi, Justin. Nice to have you with us. And it is Justin, correct?
It's Jeff. Sorry, Jeff.
Jeff. Okay, great. Yeah. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I just had a couple comments regarding the post office. One, I think to compare it to the military, where the military doesn't make a profit. I don't think that actually fits, because the military is providing a service, as general protection. It's not that they're providing, a service and then they deliver something to you, or a consumer goes and buys it and there's a monetary exchange. So I don't think that comparison, to make the argument that they're not supposed to make money or a profit doesn't actually fit. That was just a comment on that. On the comment of the post office having to fund their health, retirement benefits, and other pension benefits, they had a deficit of, I think it was over $80 billion that was not being addressed. And so lawmakers stepped in and said, one, we don't want the taxpayers to have to pay this, and two, people who are depending on these benefits, you're shortchanging them if you're not funding them. And this was a funding mechanism to get them up to speed. And you say, well, other companies don't have to do that. Well, other companies are irrelevant because they don't have those kind of benefits. The, guaranteed for life health benefits is really an anomaly and a carryover only primarily in public service. And so to say that other companies don't, have to do that, well, it's because it doesn't apply to them. One other thing on businesses want to privatize it, or they want to, run it out of business for competition. Right now, the post office has a monopoly on first-class mail. No one else can deliver first-class mail. And if you want to deliver something else, and the reason why the Federal Expresses and the DHLs and such are able to do what they do and provide a great service is it has to be, quote-unquote, urgent. And I believe that the spread between the first-class mail and what they charge has to be at least $3 more. So those are just some of the comments on that. Also, their employee costs are way out of line when you compare it to the other private sectors. What I personally would like to see is what Germany and other countries have done is privatize it. Nothing, helps more than competition. That pushes initiative, and it's hands down has done the best. So those are my comments on the post office.
I'd like to get back in here. I'm the one who – this is Sally. I'm the one who made the comment about the post office, comparing it to the military. And the reason I said that, and I know that it is a different kind of thing. However, in the Constitution, the post office was mandated because there was a need for people in a democracy to be able to receive communication from other people and news and all that kind of thing. And that's why they established a method for people to communicate with each other. And I don't think that that has stopped. You know, a lot of magazines, et cetera, benefit from a greatly reduced postal rate because they can go through the post office, and that's how I get a lot of news. Now, there may be news on the Internet, but if it's largely dug up by the publications that still send out their magazines or their newspapers. You know, you read things on the Internet, it's from the New York Times, it's from Mother Jones, it's from things that publish a magazine, and they can disseminate that to people whether they're connected to the Internet or not, because we have a post office. And that's the kind of service I was talking about, because that's so important for voters to have access to.
As far as the bulk mail goes and the reduced rates they get from that, I really view that as part of, you know, just corporatism. You know, all of the flyers and everything that you get, it's drastically reduced. Their post office is running massive deficits, delivering this stuff, losing money on it, and it's really a subsidy to big businesses.
The post office overpaid before we even got into Congress requiring them to fund their pensions into the future like no one else does. Before we even got into that, the post office had been paying into a pension plan, and there were a couple of studies that indicated that they had paid between $50 and $80 billion over payments into that fund. Now everybody has totally dropped that out of the discussion. I think because nobody can find the money to pay them back. So that chunk of money has simply gone by the wayside. And I just wanted to say,
I just want to clarify. So they paid into the fund, but the government used it somewhere else, and so that money's now missing.
I think so. Yeah, this was the federal pension plan. And nobody has talked about it for a while. Everybody got diverted into the discussion of the recent act of Congress that required them to fund, people's benefits to 75 years in the future.
Which no other government entity does either.
Right.
So when you talk about lifetime benefits, other government entities also promise lifetime benefits, but they are not required to pay to fund their retirement plan for 75 years. But
a lot of the other government programs are simply broke, and we're running $16 trillion in debt. So I don't know if those are really the ones that you want to, you know, mimic. You know, what's
I understand.
What's wrong
and
with
I'm
them
not
funding, you know, they're out for funding. They're $80 billion short.
Maybe the number, Jeff, is 50 years, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily right. I'm just saying it's not, we're not using the same yardstick for everything. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it's because it's mostly not applicable.
I would also like to say, you know, you were talking about that no one else can deliver first-class mail, but if I have documents that I want to send to my accountant, it cost me $18 to get them there in 2 days, which is a lot of money. And I do know that in remote areas of the country, services like FedEx will often get the piece of communication to a central office, and then they will send it by the post office to
a
smaller
another,
place.
Right, and
you know, and so
too,
if the post office was privatized, they wouldn't be able to do that economically.
Well, good.
And I don't know how long you'd have to wait for mail if you were in Norburn, Missouri.
Why should we be subsidizing FedEx and FedEx's delivery? That's a multi-billion-dollar company. So now we're running deficits, and everyone else has to pay for it. You know,
right.
Subsidize Federal Express. That doesn't seem right for me. It's just setting them up as, you know, as a subsidy to corporatism.
I think you're right about that. But
themselves.
But if I live in Norburn, Missouri, you know, and we privatize the post office, then how am I going to get mail? Because FedEx can't make money delivering to me because they're not going to make money on it. I'm going to get letters every 5 days.
The question that I have is, why should I you know, somebody that lives in a populated area where the costs aren't that high, why should the differential between what you should be paying and what you do pay be sent to me for me to pay, you know, along with the other taxpayers? Why should
well,
we subsidize you?
This
why
is the same concept of why. This is the same concept as why should people who don't have children have to pay for schools?
Well,
you know, we can decide as a society that it's worth it to educate our young people. We can also decide as a society that it's worth it to provide communication services to all of us. And those are decisions that we have made, and I think they were good.
As a society. Now, I just want to break in here real quick. You know, we're getting a little heated. I want to remind us all about the Civility Pledge. We're going to agree to disagree. And I'm going to open up Evan Carroll's mic. He's been really active in the chat room, and he's asked Jeff if he can talk with you. Are you okay with that? Okay.
Yeah.
So, Evan, your mic is open. This is part of Egberto's show. I'm trying to run it like Egberto.
Excellent.
So,
are
you
there,
Jeff?
Yes.
Excellent. I had a few quick questions for you. We were talking about the post office's profitability and how they have a monopoly on, you know, first-class mail. What about the monopoly that I guess you would say the private industry has on everything that's not first-class mail? Numerous times in the past, the post office has come out with pretty good ideas that the U.S. courts have said that they cannot, in fact, implement to generate a profit. Things like faxing from one location to another and other ideas that would involve going online more so than they're currently doing right now. Their mandate is specific to providing a service that people were demanding across the board in all of America, and they can't exceed, they can't go outside of that mandate. They can't engage in other forms of commerce that would generate, you know, more profit to their name.
What, the post office can't go off into other areas? Well, see, that's where you get back into it, and that's where the big issue is. When you have a government-run bureaucracy, you know, you have all these perverted incentives out there where you've got some congressman that, you know, whatever comes up, you're going to have some congressman somewhere saying, oh, no, we can't do that because it's going to hurt XYZ business. You know, this is the corporatism and this is the power that you give politicians that messes up the market in the end.
But why do you see the corporatism on the side of the post office and not the corporatism on the side of those that are petitioning the government to restrain it?
No,
you can play that on either side of it.
That corporatism exists also, and that's a big problem that we all need. Anytime any business, whether it's governmental run or it's privately run, when they're going to get special favors, and it's a lot of this gets done, when they go to get special favors from the politicians and restricting competition, that's corporatism, and I don't care what stripe they are. It's
so then
wrong.
Why fault it one way or another on it? For instance, the U.S. Post Office, in another example, has a mandate to deliver mail to every American. That's what they do. There's no American that's out of their service range. If you're in America, you can get service from the post office, and we pay and subsidize it at tremendous cost. If I want to send a letter to my neighbor, it's 45 cents.
And this is part of what Sally was talking about, is that's part of the social contract we all agreed to. You know, you personally may not have agreed to it, but as a country, we agreed to this. That every American should have access to mail.
But this is my question. Why isn't it corporatism when things like UPS say we don't have to provide mail to rural farmers because it's not profitable? How is it not corporatism that they're not regulated by that same piece, same principle that we have, that everyone should be receiving mail?
Because the post office was formed in the Constitution to be a public service. Private corporations are not a public service. To do whatever you want with them in whatever ways, it's totally different.
I just want to make
one point here, and I'm not arguing that we should not have a post office. I'm arguing that it should be privatized with certain limitations and expectations as to what they need to deliver. Right now, it's just become a big behemoth monster of billions and billions of dollars and hemorrhaging a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It needs to be privatized and let the private market deliver it.
When you talk about the post office, it is in fact held by government interest, right? The government owns 100% of the post office, but it's run as a private company in that it's solvent and it has to be paid from by postage. The government doesn't put money into their coffers. So what would you call something like a UPS where they were regulated and they had to deliver mail to all of the rural parts of the United States, right? Where they had to deliver mail Monday through Saturday because that's what the people have demanded, where they have to participate in these types of things, and they can't go outside and deliver things that are not mail because that's not what the people demand of them. You would call that version of the UPS United States Postal Service. So if you have these demands and you agree in concept that the people can make these demands and they can demand universal postal delivery, then you agree with the United States Postal Service. You just have a problem with it being called public, even though there's no difference between public and regulated private interest.
No, there is a big difference between a private corporation and not. If they don't want to participate, there's a certain number of services that need to be delivered. These services need to be delivered according to the Constitution. Refine it as that. Put it out for bid, and whoever wants to take it, takes it. It's not that you want to, since you have restrictions on some, then you go and you put more restrictions on others.
I just have a question here. Because the challenge that I have is that basically, I mean, you know, I'm a layperson. Evan here seems like he studied this a lot, but as a layperson, it seems to me that UPS and FedEx have peeled off all of the highly profitable parts of what the post office used to do and left the post office, and then the internet came along and took, you know, the bill pays, if you will, via the banks, came off and took off most of the first class mail.
But
so
that
the post office is left with the very unprofitable mail, you know, mail that delivery, house-to-house delivery, and all of the junk mail that none of us want. And then we're now mandating that they have to make a profit. And so everybody is now saying, okay, and now you have to be profitable or we're going to stop subsidizing you.
Well, whenever you talk about, you know, FedEx and UPS peeling off the profitable, you know, businesses, what that really means is they provided a service to the customers, and the customers made a value judgment that the price that they were paying and the service that they were getting, that they valued that more than the money that they gave them. So through competition, they want out competition by providing a better service.
That's not at all what that means. That is the most ideological way to read into that. It means that they cut out a service that people demanded, and because the government didn't regulate them and make the same demands of that private company, that they were able to skim out and externalize that to the public entity and make more profit in the process.
No, FedEx.
I have both interpretations, because as a consumer of that type of service, FedEx and UPS provided a more reliable service, and it was worth it to pay more because I knew I could have tracking. And UPS and the Postal Service had to step up and actually start providing tracking. So I now use the Postal Service because it's cheaper and they actually provide tracking that I can rely on. So without that competition, the Postal Service would not have provided the cheaper tracking.
I just would like to say, too, part of the reason that FedEx and UPS could provide that cheaper service was because they could
use
the postal service, which we all have to pay for.
Absolutely.
You know, because they could not. I couldn't send a FedEx to somebody in a small town if the post office didn't guarantee that last leg.
So we're subsidizing Federal Express and UPS at taxpayers' expense, which is
well. So let's stop doing that, and then make FedEx not able to deliver to small companies. Instead of changing the United States Postal Service so that it becomes UPS, you see what I mean?
The problem with the Postal Service, and I've got to run here, guys. It's been a great conversation, but the problem with the Postal Service is their employee costs are way out of line with anyone else. They have $80 billion that they need to meet, and they continually run out of money. And I, you know, personally, it is a philosophical, you know, standpoint, too, is that government-controlled entities, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, the post office, Amtrak, all hemorrhage cash. It just, government ownership of these entities do not work, period. That's my point. And with that, I'm going to sign off.
I have to disagree, but I'm sorry you have to leave. It's been a fun conversation.
Okay, thank you. Have a good afternoon.
Bye-bye.
Wow. I love it when we can do coffee party in real time. So Jeff in Chicago had to go, and I'm so sorry that he did. But
really? That was a fun conversation.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. I'll drop him a private text message or something later just to say thanks so much, because that was awesome. I love it when we actually get people that can come in and talk knowledgeably about what it is that they really stand for. And even if we disagree, it's still a fun conversation. And Evan, thank you for jumping in from the chat room too and coming in with what you have.
Yeah, I think we could talk about constitutionalism too as some type of, you know, intellectual plague where people think the answer to the problem is in fact the problem itself. We're doing all of this work right now with things like Move to amend the Constitution, and there's really a sizable percentage of people out there, even with liberal bias today, that think that if only we would do what the Constitution says, you wouldn't have these problems to begin with. And then you ask them how we got here, and they literally think that everything was done in an unconstitutional fashion. We've been hearing a lot more lately of these people keep coming on and they keep saying, well, you know, the flaws in the system today are the flawed interpretation of the Constitution. To me, that's like a biblical literacy argument.
So
how so? No, go ahead, Debbie Lynn.
Well, I was just going to say, go ahead and take it, Sally, and I just want a reminder that we have a 917 caller that's been on hold for a very long time and patiently waiting while we got through that Postal Service conversation.
You're right. I just was curious, Evan. Because I do think that a lot of interpretation means a lot. Interpretation of the Constitution. I'm not quite sure what you're saying. I mean, I don't want to make it a long conversation, but I'm curious.
Sure. So what I'm saying here is that when you look at what the Constitution did, I mean, in the first iteration of it, there wasn't even a publicly elected Senate, right? The Senate was appointed,
right,
and only the House was publicly elected. The goals of the Constitution are construed today in contemporary times to be this form of, you know, good governance where people have a say-so. And that really wasn't the ideals of those who drafted it. So the whole idea of a Supreme Court and having things read to you or coming from the top down by appointees is exactly what the Constitution created. You know, and there is a Commerce Clause, and the Commerce Clause did start the seed. And what was the Commerce Clause really made to do? It was made to allow rich, wealthy interests control things, like creating a corporations. I mean, that was undeniably, in my eyes, what the intention of that was.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, but where do you go from here is the way I would...
You solve the problem of democracy, not constitutional interpretations.
I see. Okay. That makes sense, to make the Constitution conform to democracy rather than the other way around.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, people really do believe fundamentally that if the Constitution was upheld, then even if that's not what the people wanted, that would be the best form of government for them. It's almost this authoritarian argument. But we should take it from the other side, and we should say, no, what the people want is always what the people should get. And if you look in line with it, you know, like the stances against the Iraq War, right? Is the
Iraq War
constitutional is a stupid question. The question is, do the people want to be there? And the answer is no.
That's an excellent question.
Gay rights. You know, does the Constitution approve gay rights? You know, that's a stupid question. Is it, you know, marriage between a man and a woman in the Constitution? You know, marriage is what the people want it to be, and now the overwhelming majority want it to be between men and men as well. That's also marriage. So the FDA, is the FDA constitutional? Sure it is. That's how it got there. It's the government regulating, you know, commerce, what people can take in and produce for the market for people's consumption. That's something that's constitutional. But do the people want them to regulate marijuana? Again, democracy trumps it. If people would start asking, what do the people want, they'd get it.
And Evan, the question that I have here is, you know, we've got an active thing going on in the chat room again. You know, at what... You know, we're talking about here are, you know, do we have mob rules or not? Because, you know, we also need to protect the minority from the mob rules of the majority at times. And also, you know, and then I go back to, you know, Thomas Jefferson thought that the Constitution should be rewritten every generation. So, you know, so I'm saying that, you know, so what, you know, my belief is that, yes, the Constitution needs to change as we evolve. But it does need to be, I think, rewritten from an intellectual level and not from a mob mentality.
I think that the argument about this mob mentality, the wolves voting away the sheep's life, is really just it's almost like a trite argument that the minority use to stay in power. Because what you have right now, you don't have the rule by the majority, you have the rule by the minority. And the rule by the minority gets to impose their rules on not just a minority of people, but on a majority. You have the Supreme Court who could make the decision
when you're talking about gay marriage, you're talking about a shift in 4 years.
Sure, yeah. And yeah, we're now lagging behind in 4 years and quite possibly another 10. You know, mm-hmm. So, and same thing with marijuana legalization. You know, it's just now crossed the 50% threshold. But how long will it take for those rules to trickle down and to actually see themselves in fruition?
Yeah,
you're talking about another
20
years.
I think we're talking a chicken egg thing. You know, which comes first? I'm going to, you know, Evan, I'm going to leave your mic open, but I'm going to bring in our caller from 917 because they've been holding a really long time. And thank you so much for your patience. Who are you and where are you calling from? You are. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, this is Chuck, actually from the Big Apple Coffee Party, but by way of Austin, Texas, where I am right now.
Okay.
Standing in the middle of Zilker Park. Hopefully it's not too windy.
Ah, so you know Sally.
Yes, I do. Hello, Sally.
Hi, sorry. I keep having to mute myself out because there's something wrong with the sound. But I didn't recognize your number. I'm sorry. You could have talked much more with much more knowledge about the post office than I could. I'm sorry.
Well, it was very frustrating listening to Jeff from Chicago because he's very impassioned and he almost has a lot of knowledge on the subject. Because he's using this figure of, the Postal Service was $80 million in the hole, and that was an invention by people who want to affect what he's looking for, which is the privatization of the Postal Service. I mean, the fact of the matter is that 2006, which isn't that long ago, was the biggest year in volume and in income in the history of the 237 years of the post office. It did over $67 billion in business. Even in bad years, the Postal Service still does $60 billion. The problem that a lot of people were having is the Postal Service, as it was configured starting in 1971 as an independent agency, is that it was actually self-supporting, and it was proving, at least on some level, that government can work. And there were people who looked at it, and he said, yes, the employee cost is high, but compared to what? Postal workers get a living wage. They get benefits, retirement benefits, and they even have a representation on the work floor. It's the second largest non-military employer in the United States behind Walmart. Walmart's number one, the Postal Service is number two. What's the primary difference between the conditions of the workers at Walmart and the Postal Service? As I said, postal workers make a living wage compared to Walmart workers. In many cases, we have to subsidize them with food stamps and Medicaid because they can't afford it, while postal workers are members of the middle class. The myth about the Postal Service, as Sally touched on earlier, is it's not that the Postal Service has been a drain on the government or the Treasury. It's vice versa. The Treasury has been using the Postal Service as a cash cow for decades, going back to the overcharging into the pension funds. And Sally was correct on that. Somewhere between $50 and $75 billion was overcharged because in 1971, when the Postal Service became an independent agency, it was no longer a government agency. So the Postal Service had to pay the employer's share into their employees' pensions, but they had no real way of establishing what it should be. So they arbitrarily picked a figure which, as years went on in 2003, 2006, they tried to rectify it. But the problem for the Postal Service, it was never designed to make a profit, but what does it do when it has a surplus? And that was the problem that they had with the surplus. So they came up with this idea to fully pre-fund future retirees' health benefits. Well, private corporations that gave employees benefits, they have retirement too, but none of them were required to fully pre-fund at 100%. Companies do it at 30, 38% because in time that money will grow. Right now, when the Postal Service is in all this problems and trouble financially, which is all created by Congress, There's $47 billion in that fund. Now, remember, the Postal Service every year pays the retirement and the health care of their current retirees. This is for future retirees. So
right.
That was a myth that that our friend Jeff in Chicago was passing along. He took an artificial figure, you know, created by corporations that want to privatize, forwarded by think tanks that they fund, and so forth and so on.
Yeah, I also have this vision of all these corporations that have gone bankrupt in order to get out of their funding their retirement funds. You know, the airlines come to mind. So it's kind of like, yeah, let's privatize it, and then, you know, and then what happens? So it just...
Well, I mean, we'll privatize it right away to privatize it. The only reason to pre-fund this in such a short period of time, and if they'd said, okay, the Postal Service has to pay for the future of retirees, but it'll be like, you know, mortgaging a house. You'll do it over a 30-year period. By doing it over 10 years, created this artificial crisis that put the Postal Service in this. If they said do it over 30 or 40 years, the Postal Service would have had to pay $500 million a year rather than $5.5 billion. It would have been doable. This was created to manufacture this crisis in such a way. The only rationale for doing it in such a short period was to privatize it so you could say, well, whoever was taking it over wouldn't have an unfunded liability. It would be pre-funded.
Right.
It wasn't for the government. It wasn't for the people of the United States. It was to make it more attractive to the privatizers, the people who would take it over.
It's just everything looks like a racket to me these days, Chuck. It's just everything the government's doing right now. I'm so cynical, and I came into politics about, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, and it just so much idealism and hope and wanting to, you know, improve the system, and I'm such a cynic now. It's just scary.
And it's the function that matters, that works. And the workforce, the Postal Service is the largest employer of veterans in the country. It's the largest employer of disabled veterans. It's the largest employer of women. It's the largest employer of people of color. Generations of people have moved up into the middle class, have become productive members of society, tax-paying members of society, and the service doesn't drain anything on the taxes. From the Treasury. I mean, it really is a false creation here to make people believe that, once again, one of the commons, one of the things that they rely upon, you know, should be taken away, privatized, and whatever. And it's true. The large companies are subsidized, but the people who are dependent on the Postal Service the most, they're the ones who have to pay the top increases. And who are those people? The elderly, disabled people, poor people, and small business owners. They're the ones who can't afford the alternatives to the Postal Service.
having been an eBay a shipper for a long time, I used the Postal Service a lot. Hey, just a word out there. Our phone number to call in is 646-929-2495. We just had a caller that disappeared off our screen from 720 area code, so if that's you, please call back in. I recognize that as a Colorado area code, my home state, even though I live in Oregon now. So if you're still out there listening to us, please call back in. We'd love to get you back in the queue here. Anything, Chuck, Evan, that you guys want to add on the Postal Service? We still haven't hit on North Korea, the Arkansas oil spill, crushing student debt. You guys want to talk about any of that?
Well, I'll just conclude a little bit about the Postal Service, that it's not something that couldn't be reversed. Congress could reverse it, you know, in a very short amount of time. There's legislation there introduced, in the Senate by Bernie Sanders. I wish I could remember the numbers. In the House, Peter DeFazio from Oregon, right? He introduced it.
Right.
This bill would basically solve the problem without costing the taxpayers any money. It would get the Postal Service right again, enable it to do the kinds of things that it needs to do to keep going. And it's unfortunate because it seems that the Postal Service at this point is being played. Congress isn't doing anything, and it's enabling the current administration, the leadership of the post office, Postmaster General Donahoe, who I would liken to Neville Chamberlain, is destroying the post office as much as they can, to shrink it as much as they can, so when it finally gets bailed out, what's lost is lost in terms of the post offices being closed. That's a new – the one last thing I'll talk about is what they're doing now is they're selling post offices. They feel that it's easier to sell the buildings that they own than to actually close a post office that they rent. And this is all, again, a lot of these post offices, many of them, 1,100, were built during the New Deal by the Roosevelt administration, the center of town, with great works of art, beautiful buildings,
yeah,
that became the senators of that community. And it's being done as a real estate theft from the people. This was paid for by the taxpayers' dollars, and now it's being sold to private interests. And it's interesting because the people who, like in the state of California, the real estate broker that's handling the sale of the post office in California is Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband. They say they never discussed this at home.
Oh, God.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I have the numbers. The legislation that to support, I believe, is H.R. 630 or S. S 316.
Thank you, Sally. You bailed me out again.
Not quick enough. Sorry.
Okay, H.R. 630 and S.R.
S 316.
And H.R. 630.
Got
and
it.
Please, just call up your representatives and ask them to become co-sponsors of the bill. And then if you see anything where they're trying to cut, eliminate service, take away a post office, and they usually try and sneak through these hearings. It's important that people come out to maintain the people's post office, that it's something that's ours and it shouldn't be taken away. The post office would be fine. Even with internet, even with the economic collapse in 2008, the post office survived fine if it wasn't for Congress using it as a cash cow.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking, you know, if you're talking about buildings built in the 1930s, I mean, they're going to be beautiful Art Deco buildings. I don't know about you all, but that's some of my favorite architecture.
Oh, I agree. And beautiful artwork in the General Post Office in New York City, in the Bronx General Post Office, is one of the buildings they're trying to push through. They have these fabulous murals by Ben Shong. I mean, it'll be a tragedy to lose them, but also that building is the center of a community, and this community is the poorest congressional district in the country, and they're going to take away their main post office. It's the center of the community, and all the small businesses around it, they get traffic from it. It's just it's an outrage. But listen, I'll thank you and get off the phone now. And keep up the good work, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. And maybe sometime in the future I'll get to speak at the same time as Jeff.
Thank you so much for calling in, Chuck.
All right, thank you all. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
That was great hearing Chuck call in from your home chapter for Coffee Party, Sally. Good for
there
him to
I am.
Be here.
Yes. Yeah, I was really glad he called in. I'm sorry I didn't recognize his number sooner, because he does know a lot about the post office.
So, again, the number here, Evan's still on the line with us. The number, if you want to call in, is 646-929-2495. And we still have, several topics to cover yet. What is it that gets too hot under the collar this week? We had the fast food strike in New York, Sally, you want to give us an update on what's happened there?
Sure. I just wanted, on Thursday, there were a lot of workers and supporters who congregated in Times Square. They had a one-day strike outside McDonald's. It was about trying to get a living wage for people who work in the fast food industry. There is a move in New York for a living wage on a lower level, but they're only talking about bringing it up to $9 or $10. These workers want $15 an hour because they need it. Living in this area is expensive, and the fast food industry doesn't pay people enough so that they can buy food for their own families.
And what is the minimum wage? What is the minimum wage in New York now?
I think it's seven something. I'm not sure.
So it's the same as the federal minimum wage?
I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I should know that, but I don't.
That's okay. No worries. Because I know that out here in Oregon, it is at $9 or $10 an hour. And it's not quite as expensive to live here as it is in New York.
Well, it's ridiculous. The idea of trying to pay what you need to pay to live, to raise a family in this area, I can't imagine trying to do it. It's they should be making enough to take care of themselves and their children.
Right.
Especially since we don't have health care, or many people don't. And fast food employers are not big suppliers of those kind of benefits.
Right. So they're asking for 11. I'm just Googling it right now. They're asking for it to be $11. They're asking for $9 an hour, but they actually need 11.
That's the living wage in New York campaign generally?
Correct. Correct. Right. And right now, bumping up the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage right now.
Right. But the fast food workers were talking about that what they really needed was 15.
Right.
Which makes a lot of sense. I think that probably is what you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for living where you all do and how expensive rent and stuff is there, I'm sure.
Right. Right. So, it was the second time in 6 months that they had an action of this type. There's the group that was organizing it is called Fast Food Forward, and I think they're going to be continuing to act on it. You know, even the president, when he came out with saying that the minimum wage should go up, he doesn't want to take it up as much as he wanted to take it up a few years ago, which is, you know, why did we win elections again?
Back to our first story. It's like, if you're not going to act like, you know, like what you did, what, if you're not going to carry through on your campaign promises, why the hell did you get elected?
Yeah, really.
I did read this interesting article, and if I can go back and find it real quick, I'll post it in the chat room. But it came out, I think it was in Salon, or it may have been in Washington Post. But it was an interesting article talking about the people in power these days don't have as much power as they used to because it's getting spread out and fragmenting as more and more people become empowered around the world, that the people in power no longer have as much power. There's less authoritarian power in the world in general. And it talked specifically about, you know, our Congress being gridlocked. It talked about the fall of the dictatorships in the Middle East. And how as people, you know, basically as information is spread via the internet and Facebook and Twitter and et cetera, and people become more informed, the less centralized power there is, the harder it is to govern.
Well, you know, I would wonder about that because it seems to me that while there may be less authoritarian power in the hands of governments, I think there's more authoritarian power in the hands of multinational corporations. So
I wondered about that because it was like, as I was reading this, it actually talked about that in corporate, because of the outcry and the activism, that there is also less power in corporations as well. And so I kind of questioned it. I'm going to go look for it real quick on my email threads and see if I can't find it.
Yeah, that's interesting because I find that hard to believe because that then implies that there's more power on the part of individuals. Now, there is more power on the part of individuals in some countries, but there's less in others. So I don't know. I don't know if I would believe that. It is very interesting, though.
It was like, wow. Just a different take on it.
Uh-huh. I would like to see that. I would very much like to see that. Yeah, we haven't talked. This is, I don't know how to jump from one subject to another, but I'm looking at my list and I see we didn't talk about Plan B over the counter at all yet. Do you want to go there?
Sure. You know, and I'm looking in my email, so go ahead and keep talking and keep an eye on the board to see if, in case we have a caller.
Okay.
But what did you think about the Plan B?
Well, the FDA seems to have approved being able to sell Plan B off the shelves as a safe medicine that is available, that should be available over the counter in 2006. So it's now been, almost 7 years that it has not been available, and I think that, you know, why, I don't know why it takes quite so long.
Oh, I know. Government, right?
Exactly. So this judge, Judge Corman, I think, is somewhere in New York, overruled the Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, decree that it would still not be available. So if the administration doesn't appeal, it looks as if Plan B will actually be available on pharmacy shelves within a month, which would be amazing, and I think it would be fabulous.
I think that would be great.
I've heard. Go ahead.
Well, and I just have to say, you know, one of the things I read a couple of articles on this morning just in preparation. Here's the article. I'm posting it into the chat room right now. It said why people in power are increasingly powerless.
And thank you.
And it came out March 1st, and it's from the Carnegie Endowment. It's a writer there.
Right.
One of the things on Plan B is that, you know, there was some talk about how at the end of 2011, early 2012, that Kathleen Sebelius may have actually done this as a favor to Obama so that Plan B didn't become a campaign issue, if you will, for the 2012 presidential election. And it was actually a stalling tactic.
That makes a lot of sense.
And so now is the time for it to, you know, just get out there. He no longer has an election to win. There's no next election, if you will.
Right, so they may not appeal it.
Right. And so I thought, you know, and the argument at the time was, well, you know, if you had a teenage daughter, you know, wouldn't you want her to have to talk to an adult before she started taking this medication over the counter? And it did cause me to pause for a moment and just go, well, you know, if I had a 13 or 14-year-old daughter, yeah, I would really want to know before she started putting something in her body.
Yes, but, you know, I have daughters, too, and there's an awful lot of stuff they can put in their body without my approval. And the FDA did evaluate this for safety and found years ago that it was safe for young women and for old women and for whatever. So the reason for not making it available on the shelves has
right.
been this moral component. And, I heard that. I was watching people talk about this on the talk shows, you know, and I was listening to this argument about the 11-year-old, you know, who only needs this because she's been having sex. But I was also thinking about the fact that, you know, that means that women, adult women, in areas that are politically conservative have to go to a pharmacist and ask for it. And that pharmacist cannot sell it to them. That pharmacist can say, I don't do that, go to another pharmacy. Now, I don't know, they might
be sued. And I don't like that at all. Yeah.
Yes. So in order to give parents control over their 11-year-old girls, we're taking control out of the hands of adult women in states all over the country.
Right. And especially given the assault that's happening in North Dakota, in Mississippi, and there's a third state. It's like, oh, God.
Right. And in a lot of those places, and especially in rural or small town areas, confidentiality is an issue because, man, tell you, everybody all over town knows everything really quickly. And if you have to buy it, if you have to ask for it from the pharmacist, then your privacy is seriously compromised.
Mm-hmm. I mean, given how embarrassed I was as a teenager just to buy tampons.
Really? Really? And it's bad enough to have to take them to the checkout, but asking a pharmacist is worse.
I know. And then, you know, and then you get into the whole condom issue. It's like, oh, my God.
Uh-huh. I know. It's ridiculous. You know, but I mean, small town life can be pretty overwhelming.
And that's why I said it caused me to pause, but it didn't. I'm really happy for the decision that they made, and they're going to make it available. And they said that the possibility of 10 and 11-year-olds actually purchasing this is so minuscule and causing harm to themselves, I should say. I think it's so minuscule that I'm like, yeah, let's move forward and get past this. I mean, the whole goal that would actually prevent the whole abortion argument anyway is to prevent pregnancy.
Right.
Let's just prevent it. Prevent unwanted
right.
pregnancy. We don't even have to have the other conversation.
That's right. That is so right. It makes just a huge difference. So I'm hoping that they don't appeal it, you know, but we don't know whether they will. This
right.
is me being the administration, because they appeal some things that I think they shouldn't. But
yeah, you know, like the Whistleblower Protection Act and, you know.
Mm. Yes, the national,
and
the NDAA.
Unlawful detentions. You know, I'm amazed, you know. Amazed at the things that they're talking about right now.
Exactly, exactly. So you wanted to talk about student debt.
I did, and you know, and I haven't done a lot of studying on this this week, but I've had it come up for me several times, and there was a new article out that said, you know, student debt has now increased to be more than credit card debt. So students
yeah.
are now graduating with more student loan debt than they are credit card debt. On average, depending on the states that you're in, it's anywhere from $15,000 to over $30,000 on average.
Right. And it can't be addressed by bankruptcy.
And you can never get, the only way you can get out of it is by dying.
Wow.
And then I was talking with another friend of mine recently. Actually, I have two friends who are both in their 50s, and they both felt the need in their 30s and 40s to go back to school and get a graduate degree. So they both
right.
have now student loans from graduate degrees. They're both unable to find work in the field for which they got their master's degree. So they now have like $70,000 to $100,000 loans for their graduate degrees.
Oh.
That they're going to have for the rest of their life.
Right. Right. Well, at least it won't go down to their children.
here's the thing that one of them outlined to me. She was like, so I did this, you know, 15 years ago, and I took out a loan that was, I think her loan, actually I exaggerate. I think she said her loan was $50,000. She's already paid back $62,000, and she has another like $30,000 left to go. So that's where the bigger number came from, because she borrowed at 9%.
Oh,
and
ow,
and she can't refinance it.
Right. If she had that money in savings, it would be making 0.25% interest.
Correct. So she is being forced to work and stay in the workforce longer to pay off a student loan. And she can't get out of the workforce to make room for some of these younger people who are coming
right.
up. So we're not only do we have a student debt crisis for the young people just getting out of college, but we also have an older student debt crisis for people who did graduate degrees later on, who now can't afford to retire because they have this other student debt from a postgraduate degree.
This whole question of debt is so upsetting. I've been reading some about state banks and about what is money and what is debt. And the debt of all the corporation, all the large banking interests was essentially wiped out after the financial crisis because we decided that we needed them. But it's not the same for small debtors. It's like if you're going to steal money, don't steal $20, steal $1 million or $100 million, because then they need you and they won't prosecute you, which is true. And I find that so upsetting, because people understand. I mean, you don't have to be deeply into the issues. You can talk to people who don't even like politics, but they do not believe that our legal system is fair. They believe
right.
that it treats people with money differently than it treats
correct.
People without. That's a bad problem.
Right. Yeah. And I think that is something that we're all coming to understand. And I think this is what's, you know, awakening, if you will, most of the American public right now is, you know, and actually the global population. I mean, this is what the
right.
whole Arab Spring was about, was this whole concept of, you know, we just want a fair shake. We want a level playing field and an ability to live our lives in relative safety.
Right, right.
You know.
And
And if we're going to believe in this society, we have to believe that it works fairly. It works the same for me as it does for somebody else. So if HSBC launders money with drug cartels, then they are legally liable, just like I'm legally liable if I do something against the law.
And some person actually has to pay the price.
Yes.
Or some group of people.
Yes, a fine doesn't cut it, especially if a fine is not as big as the profits they make from the from doing the deed in the first place.
Right.
I was like,
right.
Well, hey, that's a wash. I'm making money.
So, okay, I'll pay that $10 million. It's nothing compared to the $6 billion I already made.
Exactly.
And I don't have to go to jail. Yeah, I know. This is Eric Holder's, you know, that whole thing out of another disappointment out of the Obama administration right now.
It is.
You know, we did a show, Janine and I did a show on the Keystone Pipeline. I can post the link here in the chat room here in a minute. But what was great about that show was we interviewed J.D. Messenger, and he was the vice president at Exxon in charge of the Valdez oil spill cleanup.
Right.
And so, you know, so we were talking about the Keystone Pipeline and about how half of it's already built. And this is part of why the Arkansas oil spill just really irritates the hell out of me, because we've already built half the Keystone Pipeline. And anybody who thinks that pipeline's not going to get approved is crazy.
Mm.
And it's not to say that I'm not going to fight it with everything that I've got, because we don't need to screw up our environment anymore. We don't need a pipeline that goes all the way across America and endangers our water.
I just want to say right here that Bill McKibben was saying on Democracy Now! That there's a comment period open at the State Department right now. There's a link at 350.org to comment to the State Department about stopping the Keystone XL. And that comment period, I think, is open until about the 16th.
I was going to say the 18th,
now's
but
the
time. I just typed in 350.org into the chat room. We got a caller live on this one. But one of the things that J.D. Messenger talked about, where we ended the show on for that session, was that we actually, our Declaration of Independence that founded this, you know, that was the start of our revolution before the Constitution even, was actually a list of grievances against the King of England about, here is why we are breaking away from you as our mother country.
Right.
And here are all of our systems that are breaking down and no longer serving us. And JD went away from that show saying, I'm going to do that for us and then share that with you. And he went away and he wrote it down, and I contacted him the next week, and he was like, I can't stay there because it was just too sad.
Oh my.
Yeah. And so he and I are going to touch base again next week, because we were talking about how do we frame it toward to be solutions oriented, because that is his framing. He's a problem solver, and so we're going to work on reframing it so that it's not just a list of complaints, but also a list of, like, here's what we actually need to do.
Right. That sounds wonderful.
And so I'm hoping to get back in touch with him and work on it. Hey, we have about 7.5 minutes left on the show, and we have a live caller.
Excellent. I'll get off.
Okay. I'm going to open up the mic for a caller from area code 404, which I believe is an Atlanta number. Is this somebody we know?
Yeah, this is Robert Rodrigo, ladies. How you doing?
Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling in today. I was hoping you were going to call in.
Yeah, I actually just got finished at my office, long day, catching up on some things, and I hopped into my truck, and I said, oh, my gosh, look at the time. I got a call.
Just to give everybody some background, Sally and I were doing a little test show yesterday, and Robert happened to catch us and called in and let us practice with him yesterday.
Hi, Robert.
How's everybody?
Great.
I wanted to briefly comment. You know, one of the things, two things, you guys were talking about the debt and about how you were raising the point on how all of the banks were basically relieved of their debt, and yet the private debtor hasn't gotten any play. And, you know, I've been actually doing a little research. I haven't gotten anywhere with it yet, but I've been actually looking at some research into creating some kind of a class action, legal action regarding the private debt and how the private consumer was left in a lurch by these banks who were bailed out. Because if they were going to bail out the banks from their debt, why didn't they bail out everybody as opposed to it? Now, think, you know, obviously it's very grandiose, but I'm researching to see if there's any legal grounds to stand on, because it absolutely is not fair. Obviously, some of the examples that you guys gave were glaring. And then on your pipeline thing, you know, I thought I read in the middle of the week that the president had stopped all research on the Keystone post the Arkansas spill. Now, I actually have a follow-up on that. I just looked at it briefly, but I was thinking that that was done. But I got to tell you, one of the things that's important to me about the Keystone pipeline is I keep hearing about, you know, that it's going to create 10,000 jobs and that, you know, the oil is going to be ours. You know, the problem with the information, again, it's disinformation, is that it's pretty much been proven that the job thing is pretty much, it's really not a big deal. It's short-term jobs, you know, that don't have any, there are some high-paying ones, but it's short-term jobs.
I can just cut in here on this one, Robert. There's going to be a few thousand construction jobs, maybe, that are temporary,
right,
as the pipeline gets built. The long-term permanent jobs that it's going to create is somewhere between 35 and 37.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that confirms what I have said. Exactly. The other thing is that, first of all, they're talking, you know, there's more talk about, I love it when they talk about, anybody talks about the fuel and oil industry, because, first of all, we don't buy fuel from the Middle East. We put that to bed a long time ago. At this point in our history, we are buying less fuel out of this country than ever before. And most of our stuff is bought right here in the Western Hemisphere, up and down. And the stuff that's in the pipeline isn't necessarily ours either. It goes right onto the ships in Houston and out the door. Now, and of course, then we're also talking about tar sands. So there's a lot of disinformation about that when they get into that argument. And it's like it sits for a little while and there's no conversation, and then it starts up again in the same old stuff as we had that has already been proven to be not true. And it seems like it's happening once again as they gear up to try and get the Keystone Pipeline. I'm hoping I read right and that the president did stop it, and I'm hoping that, of course, it doesn't get approved, obviously.
Right, of course. But, I think it's just a matter of time. And even Obama said to the extent we can believe him, the only way that the Keystone Pipeline isn't going to be approved is through tremendous, tremendous public outcry. And I don't know what, you know, I mean, millions of people in the street could not dissuade Bush from starting the Iraq War. So I don't know what is going to dissuade Obama from starting, you know, because it's going to dissuade the Keystone Pipeline from going in, you know, being signed by executive order.
Well, not that polls or people's opinions actually make a difference, but I just saw something from George Mason University. They did a survey of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents and found that a majority of the people who responded said they felt that America should be taking steps to address climate change. And it was 62%.
Yeah.
That knocked my socks off.
Yeah, well, a lot of that has to do with the common sense stuff that's going on from people. I don't know if you guys saw Bill Maher last night, but the young man from Louisiana was on talking about science. And a lot of it has to do with common sense stuff like that going on and all of the scientists that are backing that kind of rhetoric, because it's true. I mean, at one point, we've got to stop the debate and move on with the solution, like they were saying last night.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think we've debated to death.
Well, it's true. You know, and it's like one of the points that has been made, you know, that people who are against climate change, oh, there's still a debate, there's still scientists that disagree. Okay, so what you're telling me is that science never reaches a point where you accept the answer and move on. And the greatest example is we're not still debating about whether or not the world is flat. It's a great example. You know,
right.
We don't need to debate that anymore, so we need to move on to what it really is. Well, the climate change debate needs to stop, and we need to go to the solution aspect of the debate and leave the whether or not it's real alone, because overwhelming. Scientific community is overwhelming in favor.
Well, and that's what 350.org is about. They actually have numbers. They have numbers, you know, for us to work with, and I just want to say, you know, we've got about a minute and a half left here on the show today, and definitely, you know. Their credo, if you haven't heard yet, is calling for people to sign a pledge of civil disobedience. They've got 50,000 people signed up already. they're looking for 100,000. So if, you know, if anybody out there is willing to do civil disobedience to stop the Keystone Pipeline, go to Credo. I think it's credo.com, and you can find their action pledge. I'm going to go ahead and just do a little NPR moment, what we call our NPR moment here, because Coffee Party Radio is completely member supported. And it's through people like you making contributions that keep us on the air and keep us rolling. So this is Be the Media, and you are definitely part of that. I appreciate everybody listening to us. You can go to coffeepartyusa.com and click on Be a Member. If you are already a member, thank you so much, because it's through people like you that keep us going and rocking and rolling today. And there are three other radio shows besides this one, which is Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. Sally and I are sitting in here today filling in for Egberto while he's off at a Coffee Party board member unretreat. The other three shows on Mondays, and I don't have time to tell you. So actually, have a great afternoon, and we'll see you next time on Politics Done Right with Egberto. Thanks.